Welcome to the Denim & Boots podcast, the show for people who love heritage style and honest craftsmanship. Themed Made in Japan, in this second season, we talk to influencers and industry insiders to learn more about why Japan has been so influential for heritage style menswear. And joining us today, we have a very special guest. We have W. David Marks, the author of Ametora, How Japan Saved American Style, and I'm holding my copy with me right now, just to make sure that I said that correctly. So welcome, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's an honor to have you on the show, and we've really been looking forward to this one, and I'm sure we'll get some great stuff out of it. So I think, why don't we just get into it, and let's start with, who is W. David Marks?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm from America. I've been living in Japan about 16 years, and I wrote this book, but I'd been writing about Japanese culture and fashion and music for quite a long time on the web and for a lot of American magazines. And this was kind of a culmination of things I'd been interested in a long time, going into kind of one story about how American style came into Japan and how now Japan is exporting that to the rest of the world. And so why I wrote this book and how I ended up in this topic, I'm super happy to discuss.
Now, before we get to the interview, I just wanted to remind you that you can find the show notes for this episode and all the other episodes on denimhunters.com. You can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like it, please leave a rating and a review. It really helps us. Now, let's get back to the interview.
I grew up in Pensacola, Florida, mostly, which is a not particularly big town. I think people think of Florida, think of Miami or something like that. And Pensacola is much more southern. It's about 30 minutes from Alabama, and not a lot going on. But one of the things was that Pensacola had a sister city connection to a small town in Japan. And so when I was 17, I had this opportunity to do a three-week homestay in Japan in the mountains, and totally loved it. Came back to the U.S. wanting to study Japanese, and then went to college and studied Japanese for 4 years. And I had, you know, Japanese class basically every day for my entire college career. And after my freshman year, I ended up going to Tokyo on this work internship for Kodansha, the publisher. And I was just kind of generically into pop culture. This is before the real big anime boom or manga boom, and I've never been especially into that stuff, but this was 1998. And I was working for a couple of the manga magazines, and then they stuck me in the two fashion magazines, one called Hot Dog Press and one called Checkmate, and didn't really know what was going on, had not much interest in fashion. And but I was very into this musician, Cornelius, who was a very kind of avant-garde pop musician in Japan who was very big at the time. And Cornelius gets his name from Planet of the Apes. And so I was very into Planet of the Apes at the moment. And I had was looking through an issue of Hot Dog Press, and I saw someone wearing a t-shirt with a Planet of the Apes face on it. And this was a Bathing Ape, the brand. But at this point, you know, nobody in, you know, outside of Japan knew what this brand was. And I was like, well, I want that shirt because I like Planet of the Apes. And I went to the store, and the first day I went, they wouldn't let me in, even though it wasn't closed yet. And I felt that was very strange. And then I went back the next day, and I waited about 3 hours in line to buy a t-shirt. And the t-shirts were like, you know, probably the equivalent about US $65, which at the time, as an American, was an insane thing, because t-shirts were like $20 and not $65. So on one level, just on a personal level, I was like fascinated and got very into streetwear and kind of was introduced to that world. At the same time, when I got back, and since I was like studying East Asian studies and needed a, you know, research topic and a thesis topic, I kept telling professors, like, there's these crazy phenomenon where people are waiting in line to buy t-shirts from a brand that doesn't advertise, kind of hides the stores. There was really no signage on those Bathing Ape shops at the time. And, you know, people are willing to wait in line a long time for these products, and then they're kind of, you know, flipping them on the internet or up the street for double the price. And there was just like a lot going on that I had no real touch points for. And the idea that a brand would try to make its commerce difficult, I think at the time also was very interesting to me. So I ended up writing my senior thesis about a bathing ape, and that came out in 2001 when the brand was still pretty unknown outside of Japan. And my general sense was it was very underground, that it was very big with kind of James Lavelle and Mo Wax and a very small scene of streetwear people in New York and London, and that was it. And then once I turned that in, like a couple years later, then Nigo, the designer, hooked up with Pharrell Williams, and it became this massive global hip hop brand. And so I kind of covered the first chapter of the brand, which is when it was just doing all the underground street marketing. And so from there, I kind of was interested in Japanese underground culture and fashion more generally, and also the question of just why were Japanese kids so much more fashionable than any, you know, it, just being from the U.S. where men's fashion was almost a taboo, it was so ignored. I was fascinated with just the idea that everyone was dressing well, but also the idea that you could be fashionable by just wearing the perfect t-shirt with the perfect jeans with the perfect sneakers.
Hmm. So that's the time when you moved out there.
Well, I after college, I moved to New York for about 2 years, and I worked for a magazine called Tokion, which was a half Japanese, half English, bilingual street culture magazine. It was down on Clinton Street, just right as the Lower East Side was kind of growing. And they were covering all the street artists. And I ended up kind of writing the last bit of Japan content they were doing, because they were moving more and more towards being a real U.S. street culture magazine. And so I was doing some Japan articles and interviewing Japanese musicians and doing things like that. After that, I came back to Japan to get a master's degree in marketing consumer behavior, wanting to kind of study in more detail these processes that were making everybody all buy the same things that magazines were telling them to buy, which was what I kind of discovered was at the heart of why people were so obsessed with Bathing Ape.
Yeah, I know. So that was something you talked about a lot in several times in the book was, and I think it was the Japanese person who even said so in the last chapter, where they said like the Japanese like to, like they use magazines and these guides as like their actual Bibles. They, somebody needs to tell them what to do or like how to dress like the exact way. Yeah. Or something along those lines.
That's right. And one of the things that was kind of hard about doing it in an academic way is I was seeing this phenomenon where designers were telling me you would have, you know, one shirt be made in black and red and green, but in the magazine, only the black version would be featured. And so in the stores, the kids would only buy the black version of the shirt and they wouldn't buy the red and the green. Like, so,
oh my gosh. You know,
magazines were not just kind of introducing you to the brand or the style of clothing, but they were literally saying this specific shirt is the one that is okay to wear and the others aren't. And that kind of power I was needing to write about, but, you know, it was hard to write about it without saying more or less that people are following this like sheep, you know, like they're just following it without much individual thought. And that's, you know, in from an academic standpoint, that's not kind of a conclusion you want to come to. And so it's taking me a while to find a more nuanced way of saying that and describing it. But, you know, that wasn't just me stereotyping the behavior and trying to explain what I see. I think the designers themselves were understanding it that way as well.
No, I don't think so either, especially because you actually kind of have a quote of, you know, one of the Japanese people saying it themselves too. So that's kind of backing up that it's definitely beyond just a stereotype. Like, that's not you making an assumption. That's, you know, you have it from the horse's mouth.
That's right. And the other thing you notice once you've kind of followed Japanese street culture long enough or gone out to Harajuku long enough, especially, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, is you see really crazy clothing and like very strange ensembles, very strange wardrobes that the first time you see them, you're like, that is so creative. Like,
oh, yeah.
How in the world did they put that together? And then you see it like exactly the same outfit, you know, on a different person 2 days later. And, you know, 5 years later, you kind of see, oh, this is just, there's literally like a manual for dressing crazy.
So it's funny you say that, because so I'm into like the Japanese denim and the boots and the leather jackets and, you know, the heritage menswear, whatever you want to call it. Right. And my sister is actually into like Decora, and she used to do like Lolita and all that stuff too. So like I also spent a lot of time in like Harajuku as like, well, and in like, I forget what the street's name is, but like we went into the shops there and we bought she got stuff there as well. Like, so I've seen like all like the crazy Harajuku fashion and everything like that too. There's a lot of these like very, I don't want to say like extreme, but very particular styles and fashions, I guess would be the way I'd describe it.
Yeah, I mean, I think whatever you can think of as a subculture or an underground style, there is a very organized consumer, I don't even want to call it a subculture, it's like a consumer lifestyle that's built around these things. So it's not people that are actually rebelling from society in the sense of like dropping out and creating a counterculture or creating an alternative way of living. It's just like they're doing what everybody does, which is follows the media and imitates their status icons to figure out how to dress, but they're just doing it for these very specific niche looks that in the West are considered to be somewhat outside of the mainstream. And so for every look you can imagine, there's, you know, some sort of media in Japan that has championed it and kind of given people who don't know anything about it a way to just start from scratch. And that's just, it's a nature of, some of it's a nature of Japanese culture, but some of it's also the, and what I try to talk about in the book is, if you just look at the historical circumstances, is that, you know, everything we're talking about in terms of Japanese people wearing jeans or crazy pink shirts or whatever, I mean, this is all imported culture, right? I mean, there isn't a native culture of wearing pants and shirts and suits. That's all imported. And the word for clothing that you use in Japanese is yofuku, and yo means Western. And so, you know, when you think about it, if you're importing everything from scratch, there has to be some sort of manual that teaches you how to do it at a certain degree. Mm-hmm. And I think Japan developed that so quickly that it just was able to create a really rich culture where they could import things very quickly and have people understand why they should wear it, how they should wear it. And then that manifests on the street as this like very, very shiny youth culture that, you know, that was something that I noticed and made me very interested in Japan. And I think that's what everyone else is interested in as well.
And I think that's one of the things in the book that also really caught my attention. It made me realize the connection also where you talk about Kensuke Shisu and his van brand and men's club and how they're connected and everything. That magazine, I guess, was the first to catalog clothing in a way to guide consumers. And you also mentioned that they needed it to be okay for people, for men, to care about clothing and that it wasn't about vanity. By turning it into this manual they had to follow, right?
Yeah, on that point, somebody in Japan commented about my book and said, you know, it's a fashion history, but it's also a media history. And the... Yeah. If you haven't read the book and you're listening to this podcast and you're wondering why we're talking about magazines so quickly, it's because they're so intertwined that you can't talk about one without the other. And I think the book shows very clearly the degree to which there could be no Japanese fashion culture without the magazines, because the magazines were the way that they took this totally foreign culture of men dressing up, which wasn't particularly big, and then later kind of Ivy League and all these other styles, and explain what they were, again laid out exactly how you would wear it, what, you know, what you should buy, how you should put it together, and then people from around the country could get this information and all you know, go out, buy the clothing, wear it, and know what they're doing. And so you had to have the magazines to create the culture. And, you know, there's obviously culture can spread in much more organic ways, people to people, but you don't get the clean, obvious patterns of culture that you see in Japan without a very organized media system. Yeah. And it starts from the very beginning. And another point here is not just this magazine's not an independent player in all this. So the magazine's trying to get men to dress better, to support the ready-to-wear industry. And Van Jacket is one of the leaders in men's ready-to-wear clothing, and it's buying half the issues, it's buying the back cover, it's directing all the editorial, and until about sometime in the late 60s, Van Jacket is basically setting every month's agenda in the magazine. So, you know, it is an organ of the brand from the very beginning, and it became a little bit more independent later. But even today, when you talk to editors, they see their job not as, we are an independent voice of style, and we look at everything and then kind of put stuff together, which I think is what editors in the US think of their work is. They see it more as we work with our advertisers to present things to readers.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I love the way it's all tied in together, like the way they're so intertwined. And my favorite part about the book is when you turn it back, that concept on its head of like, when you talk about like with the raw denim coming back to the United States, and you have the Japanese denim owners that are like confused as to why the American, you know, people into denim are like, at, you know, asking how to properly wash their jeans and do all this stuff. It's completely turned on its head that like now the Americans are importing back like that denim thing, and they are starting guides and the same kind of thing of how to properly wear Japanese denim, which is kind of what the Japanese did back in the day with, you know, American Ivy style and things like that. So
right, and my point there is, I mean, obviously the irony is funny, and
yes,
that's like seeing that's great, and as a writer, like being able to have that kind of callback to something is quite amazing, but. You know, a lot of what powered me or motivated me to write about Japan when I was, you know, straight out of college was just the amount of misdiagnosis and misanalysis of Japan is incredible. And I think there's so much that there's so many places where people say, well, Japanese people are so different and therefore they do X. And, you know, Americans are not like that, so they do Y. And when you kind of put people in the same situations, they often end up doing the same things because their behavior is in the end of the day rational. And so, you know, what I'm trying to show there is it's not that there's something very specifically Japanese that happened in the 60s in Japan, as much as there was something, you know, with that certain media and material environment that people in that environment acted a certain way. And then when you flip it where Americans are in the same situation, they kind of act the same way. And so I think that's a really important point for me to make. It's just I try to explain as much as possible with the historical circumstances, not just saying, you know, Japanese people have been like this for 3,000 years and therefore XYZ.
Yeah, no, I think you did a great job of that, because what I got out of it was it's when people import fashion or style and it's new to them, it's not something that they're used to, they want to know how to do it properly when it's something new. And essentially that's something that happened in Japan, and then it's happened in the, you know, in the 60s, starting in the 60s, I guess you would say, and then it happened again in the like early 2000s when, you know, Japanese denim and everything came back to America. So yes, it does work in both ways. And I guess on that point, so then I know one of the questions we wanted to ask was, why did American style need saving? I would want to change that slightly, because, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but after reading the book, I would say that like at the beginning period, so like, you know, the 50s and the 60s during, you know, the, when they take Ivy and the Van jacket and everything, did American style actually need saving at that point? Or did it just turn out that it was very fortunate that Japan did what it did, and Japanese, the people in charge, you know, that were the proprietors of the Japanese style, was it fortunate that they turned out to do what they did? Because starting in like the 90s, as you kind of mentioned, it turned out American style did need saving. It didn't need saving at the beginning, but it needed saving later on. Is that accurate to say?
Totally. I mean, if you think about Ivy League style in particular, you know, yes, there was a style known as Ivy League style in the US that, it was a certain suit style that had recognition, but also, you know, if you read Life magazine or you read like Reader's Digest or whatever, there were certain, you know, button-down shirts and Shetland sweaters and things that people in the United States understood as, oh, that's what the Ivy League kids wear. But like when you went to an Ivy League campus, you bought your clothing at the, you know, local college shop, and they basically only had the clothing that was Ivy League clothing. And so, you know, you didn't have to run out and be like, I'm going to buy Ivy League clothing on an Ivy League campus to dress that way. It was kind of just, you were imitating the kids around you, the older kids, the cooler kids, and you really didn't have that many different options. And so that culture was just a natural organic growth out of, you know, people not really paying attention. And yet that culture is strong. But then because of that, you know, it fades pretty quickly after 1965 because, you know, hippies are in, a lot of those kids are much more countercultural. They're intentionally not wearing that clothing anymore. They're wearing different things. They're wearing jeans. Those campus shops exist for the alumni, and they still kind of exist. Like, the clothing still is around. In the late 70s and early 80s, you get the preppy revival, so a lot of it comes back, and then you get a lot of, you know, kids aren't going to those schools still dressing that way, but then it fades naturally again. And so, because no one's really taking it seriously as this cult, then instead they're just kind of, you know, it's a real culture of people dressing in an organic way. It didn't need saving because it was very strong, but then the minute it collapses, it really needs saving because nobody is paying attention to it. And so what the Japanese did by not having it as an organic thing and having to like reconstruct all the rules of how it works and describe it and to rebuild it and to actually make the clothing, you then have the formula to preserve it forever. And so Take Ivy, the photo book, is a great example of where, you know, we have this photographic evidence now, thanks to the Japanese photographers and Van Jacket, the brand, of what people looked like in May 1965. That's probably actually not the real peak of that style. It's where you start seeing it getting much more casual, but pretty good photographic evidence. And then the kind of formula for the clothing and all these guides exist in the Japanese magazines much more than it ever existed anywhere else. And so if, you know, Ivy League clothing was wiped off the planet at this moment and we had to recreate it from scratch, we have tons of archival material in Japan that we can use. I'm not sure in the US that we had the instructions written out in the same way. And so I think that archiving ended up saving it, because when people about 2008-09 outside of Japan decided to bring back the style of their fathers and grandfathers and start dressing like that again, they noticed that, oh, Japan's already doing what we're trying to do. And they just kind of cribbed from the Japan notes.
And now we're talking about Ivy style. And as a European, that's actually not something I'm super familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Denim and Boots podcast. And if you know Ivy, it's about button downs. It's about tweed blazers. It's about chinos.
Yes.
It's preppy, or whatever you want to call it these days.
Right.
But it started with Ivy. But could you explain to the listeners, maybe if they also haven't read the book yet, how did it all start?
That's right. So, you know, when people think about Japan adopting American style after the war, they just kind of assume, well, the Americans came for the occupation. It makes sense that people imitated how the soldiers dressed, and then American style kind of grew from there. And what I show in the book is that really American style doesn't get picked up in Japan until about 20 years after the war ends. So during the occupation, the soldiers were there, but they're mostly wearing uniforms when people see them. If you were able to go into a base, you would see them maybe wearing jeans and a sweater or something. And a lot of people during the Korean War, like Marines and American soldiers, would come to Japan for vacation, and they'd be wearing jeans and sweaters and things. And so, you know, you saw some of it, but there was no way to buy it other than secondhand and pretty expensive, and you had to go to black markets and things like that. So there was just no system in which you could imitate an American and how he dressed easily, and there was really no incentive to do it. And so it came to Japan in an incredibly artificial way, which is entrepreneurial businessman named Kinsuke Shizu had a brand called Van Jacket that was selling high-end men's suits that were not tailor-made, but they were ready-to-wear. And the ready-to-wear market was very young, and rich people wanted to buy tailored clothing. So he needed to
find... this was the 50s then.
This is the early 50s and kind of in the mid 50s, and he's relatively successful, but he's just not getting the big break that he wants. And he realizes that old people have already made up their mind and they're just going to wear tailored clothing. So if you could get to young people who are getting a little bit more wealthy as the economy gets better, then you could open an entire market of youth fashion. But the problem was that young people all wore uniforms, and if you put them out of uniforms, they kind of looked like delinquents. And so he had to find a style that he could sell in Japan that made young people not look like delinquents. And so there was a couple styles at the time that were a little bit more rebellious, like wearing Aloha Hawaiian shirts and things like that. But he knew that would make them look like delinquents. And so he did a world tour in 1959, and he went to Princeton University, and he saw all these kids wearing what is now understood as classic Ivy League style. So tweed jackets, button-down shirts, regimental ties, chino or wool pants, loafers, and he realized it looked young and it also at the same time did not make them look like delinquents. And so he went back and retooled his brand Band Jacket to be an Ivy League brand and to explain in Japan what Ivy League style was. And that was relatively successful pretty quickly. But the problem was that the kids started dressing like that and hanging around Ginza, which is like the nicest neighborhood in Tokyo, right before the Olympics. And the police, who again thought anybody outside of a uniform that was under the age of 18 or even 22 was a delinquent, started kind of rounding them up and putting them in police vans and shipping them out. And so the police were very mad at Van Jacket for creating a style that they believed was leading to delinquency. And so Van Jacket realized they had to do a much better job of explaining what Ivy League style was. And so the book Take Ivy actually comes from them going in 1965 to the US to try to get documentary evidence that of what Ivy League style looks like, but also that Ivy League style is the elite American style. So when they go back and show the film, everyone says, oh, I get it. So this is like what rich people in America wear. And that really legitimized Ivy League style. And that really kicks off youth fashion. So once, you know, the police and parents and authorities are kind of okay with kids dressing outside of their uniforms, then you start getting more elegant continental styles. And pretty soon after that, you get hippies and jeans and all that. So it starts with Ivy League style, not because that was what necessarily was, you know, big in the US at the time, although it was on its last legs in the US when it started getting imported into Japan. But, you know, it was from this real artificial action of bringing, we need something to sell in Japan. Oh, Ivy League style works perfectly for us, so let's import Ivy League style.
And I love the part in the book where the police are rounding up the kids and they're bringing in Kensuke Shisu to tell them not to basically hang out in the street, right? So the police are happy and Kensuke is sort of the hero.
Yeah, no, so it's really crazy, but you know, the police kept basically calling Van Jack and said, get over here because you're causing us a lot of problems. And, you know, Kensuke Shizu was very charming and like, you know, won them over basically by explaining everything. But they showed him the film of Take Ivy because it was a film before it was a book. And the cops were like, oh, we get it now. This is great. So then they did this big youth delinquency event in Ginza, and they invited a bunch of kids. They basically said, you can come and we'll give you free Van Jacket bags if you show up, which was a big kind of status symbol at the time. And so they all watched the film, and then, you know, Kensuke Shizu got up there and explained, this is what Ivy League style is, and it's not delinquent, and you're driving everyone crazy, so stop hanging out. And that was like the end of summer vacation anyway, so they all went back to school and kind of disappeared. And so the police thought that, you know, he was a genius and had all this power over the kids. And then they knew that they could always call him to fix things. And then from there, it, you know, again, it's like all of this just got much more accepted, and the social norms changed, and this kind of drama went away.
It's interesting because it's not as, you know, there's parallels with that between, like, you know, an American style too, with like sort of how, you know, jeans were seen as something that was delinquent at first. And then,
yeah, I mean, the same with long hair. I was, you know, doing some writing about the Beatles haircut, and the thing, you know, today we remember the Beatles for the music, but if you just go back and read reactions to the Beatles from like 1963 to 1964, when they're showing up in America, it's all about their hair. I mean, people are just just going crazy that like, how can men have hairstyles like this? And so today it just looks ludicrous. But you know, things were very conservative at the time, and that kind of hairstyle freaked people out the same way that in Japan wearing, you know, clothing that wasn't a uniform freaked people out.
So if we go back to then, I mean, it's then the mid 60s, and the police are happy. Kensuke Shizu is the hero, and then we're getting into sort of the counterculture period. Could you explain a bit about that and what your research learned or taught you?
Yeah, so when I decided to write the book, originally it was going to mostly focus on the Ivy League story, because that's, I had met one of the authors of Take Ivy, and thought there was enough kind of arc just with that. And then when I talked to the original publisher I kind of pitched this to, they said, you know, why don't you do something on Japanese jeans too, because Japanese denim is so big and no one really knows what happened there. And I didn't either. I didn't know any of the history, and all I knew were kind of the kind of fake history that's been created about this. And we can talk about that more later. But so I was very interested in kind of the story of jeans in Japan because I knew nothing about it. And there's not a kind of single book in that explains it all in Japanese. And so I had to go to a lot of different sources. And there's a lot of myth around it, and there's a lot of, you know, modern invention of a kind of backstory. But, you know, basically, jeans were a black market good from the in the 1940s. Like, if you were really rich and could get access to the Army PX stores, you could maybe get a new pair. Or if you went overseas, which is very rare, you could get a new pair. But everyone's wearing these, like, very old jeans, and they're really expensive, and nobody can get their hands on them. And so, you know, a bunch of companies about to go bankrupt in the 60s in this really obscure town of Kojima, Okayama, start making Japan's first jeans as a way to basically save the business, just because those black market stores are telling them, we can't keep enough stock, we can't get enough stock of American imports, so could you make Japanese jeans, because you guys can make, you know, other things. And to get the denim, they had to import it all from the U.S. because no one made denim in Japan at the time. You know, the whole idea of that Japan has this great tradition of indigo dyeing, it does, but it no one was making, you know, denim with it at the time. And they start making jeans, but they're not very popular. And really, their big breakout moment was the rise of the student movement. And so the student movement starts in the early 60s, but it really gets steam in about 67. When you start having street riots in Tokyo, and these are really hardcore Marxist, hard left Trotskyite groups. So they're not just kind of like students for democracy. It's like this Marxist fashion, there's this Marxist Trotskyite faction, and then they're battling this Maoist faction. And then they don't like this structuralist Marxist faction. But this, I mean, it's really, really arcane. But all these groups were out there kind of battling cops and battling right wing people, battling each other. And if you wore jeans, it was great, because if you're running around and you don't want to get, you know, tear gas, you know, you don't want to get tear gas and you want to throw a Molotov cocktail, and you're wearing jeans is perfect. And so jeans had a really breakout moment in 67 from that. And then from there on, they just get tied up with the counterculture, and the brands like Big John start selling jeans with a bunch of ads that are very focused on the counterculture as well. So, you know, the counterculture starts, and the counterculture also, you know, Van Jacket and Ivy was so established at that point of rich kids that there was a very intentional rejection of Ivy League style in wearing jeans. I mean, that's very similar to the US, I think, but, you know, people were wearing jeans and dressing like hippies because it was against the preppy style. And so by the late 60s, you kind of had two warring factions of youth culture. You had the Ivy kids, and then you had the hippie kids. But the fascinating thing is they're both kind of using American style to define themselves.
Yeah, well, I love the more we talk about this, the more I see like the parallels between America's own development or changes in style and Japan's. It's actually, you know, more similar than I even would have thought, actually, which is kind of interesting. So what I found also very interesting, and I forgot, this is something that I wasn't as aware of, because it's not something I've ever really, well, I only cared about when I was very, very young, and not to this degree, but the incredible amount of influence that Japan has had on streetwear as well. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, with brands like a Bathing Ape, and actually it's funny, it's like when I went to LA, and we went to the Supreme shop, and it was right next to the Bathing Ape store, which is pretty funny. So, but I find it amazing, like, how that also still has ties into, like, basically everything is tied to Van in some way. It's kind of amazing. Like, almost everything can trace its root back to, even Uniqlo. Like, yep. That was the thing that kind of like blew my mind the most, is that like even Uniqlo can trace its roots back to Van, and even like the streetwear can kind of trace its roots back to Van. So it really is amazing how much influence that had. Is there anything you can say about like how all of this ties in together, and how like even the streetwear can sort of be related to like the Ivy style and Van and all of that sort of thing, and even the denim too?
Yes. I mean, that's, I think, the number one thing I discovered that made me want to write this book was how it all interconnected. And it made me realize, oh, this will be a very easy book to write because you're following a set of characters and they're kind of all moving forward. And as they move forward, creating the next style, and then you have new characters kind of pop up who then go off and create the next style. And, you know, when you tell any kind of cultural history, you always craft a narrative out of chaos. But I think in the example here, you don't have to really carve a narrative or make a fake narrative because literally the same people are responsible for everything. And so, you know, if you just take one example of, you know, you have Kinsuke Shizu making Van Jacket and working on Men's Club, and then Men's Club hires an illustrator pretty early named Yasuko Kobayashi, who's one of the maybe third or fourth men's illustrators, fashion illustrators. But he's into Ivy stuff, but at the same time, he's kind of wearing jeans and a little bit more countercultural. And then he starts doing stuff for a magazine called Hey Bone Punch, which was pretty Ivy at the time. And then they go overseas for the first time to the U.S. to chronicle the countercultures. And so now he's getting really into hippie stuff, and he becomes kind of an ambassador for that. He discovers the whole Earth catalog in 1969, comes back, gets everybody and his friends obsessed with the whole Earth catalog, which then turns to something called the Made in USA catalog, which comes out in 75. That is really the start of where the Levi's 501 obsession comes from. And the new obsession kind of with outdoor gear that happens in the 70s called Heavy Duty. This guy Kobayashi actually gives it the name Heavy Duty. And then that magazine is so successful that the editors go on to found Popeye magazine, and he helps the Popeye magazine people move Popeye to be about California and surfing and skateboarding. And so that whole boom also comes out of Popeye, and that was Kobayashi's thought as well. And so then from Popeye, the first wave of street influencer kids were reading that, and Hiroshi Fujiwara, who is the godfather of street culture in Japan, he was a model and a columnist for Popeye, and then went on to found Japan's first streetwear brand, Good Enough, and then his protege Nigo founds Bathing Ape. So, you know, everything is very, very easily connected, it makes my job as an author very easy. It's that I don't have to just invent a fake narrative, but again, I just can write what happens. But I was surprised with that too, and
sorry to interrupt you, David, but you say it's easy, but no one did this before you. I mean,
yeah,
that's why it's such a milestone. I remember when I was writing my book, and this was 2015, and that's, you know, when your book came out, and I was able to read this and get some of, you know, learnings for my book that I, you know, otherwise couldn't get anywhere, because this information wasn't out there before your book. So, I mean, it might have been easy, but, you know, it's still a huge milestone.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that. Give yourself some credit. Like, it also helps that, like, you know, you made it that easy to tell all of those things, right? Like, it's, even if it sounds easy, like, you can read a book or you can have people explain things, and something that should be easy to understand is not. And I loved that. It made it very easy to follow, and it did make it very clear by the, because I remember when I first started reading the book, like in the beginning, I was a little bit like, it was a little bit confusing. And then, like you said, like you're kind of creating order from chaos, or like a narrative from chaos. And it got really easy to follow, like around the middle part and through the end. Like, it was really easy to read, like through the streetwear and the denim parts by the end, because even though I knew like nothing about the streetwear stuff, because it's easy to follow those threads now. So that, but I wonder now, and I don't know if we have the answer, but that might be something I wonder if that's the similar, or if it's different from like American style, because I don't know if it has that same level of ties. But another thing that's very interesting, as you pointed out, is now with modern American style, to bring it back again, it's like I said earlier, maybe American style didn't need saving initially when Japan first discovered it and got really into it, but it certainly needed it by, you know, the 90s and 2000s. And I loved seeing how much influence Japanese style really has had on American style today. Because for me, I only really looked at it as far as like the denim and the boots and the heritage menswear stuff, right? And that's a niche. That's still pretty niche, especially now. But it was amazing to see how much influence there was far beyond that, right? That you pointed out with like Tom Brown and Ralph Lauren and like Pharrell Williams and people like that. So that was kind of amazing. I forget exactly, because can we go back and talk about like
Sure. What
it was that really got people, especially like a Bathing Ape, to become popular in the United States? Because I want to say that would be one of the biggest, one of the ways that Japanese style really kind of blew up in the West, correct?
Yes. I mean, it was definitely the first time you turned on MTV and you see people like proudly wearing Japanese brands. The kids at home may not know what MTV is, but you know, MTV was like the arbiter of cool when we were growing up. You know, and so, you know, music videos like rappers are wearing Bathing Ape being like, I have this and you don't. Or I mean, I think like, who is it? Soulja Boy. There you go. Like,
yeah, oh, Soulja Boy.
Yeah. So I think like Soulja Boy has like a line in one of his songs, like, he's really wants to get his hands on some Bapesta sneakers, you know? So it's like that kind of lust for a Japanese brand. Bathing Ape is the clearest example. Ebisu, a couple years before, I think, had gotten a little bit of that. And that's kind of a roundabout way, which is that Ebisu did a very good job of establishing itself in Hong Kong and then worked with a British businessman in Hong Kong to kind of take it to the UK. And then from the UK, it kind of went to the US. But, you know, Bathing Ape was, you know, when I was following it, it had this incredible culture around it in Japan that just no one else in the rest of the world was paying attention to, because you couldn't. And you know, The Face, I think in 99, called it like truly underground because you just couldn't get your hands on it. You know, you would go to either a store called Recon in New York or the Hideout in London, and they would have a couple of shirts once in a while, but it was very, very hard to get and very expensive. And there was an article that I kind of helped with in the New York Times in 99, where they were talking about it as like the brand that the Cognoscenti, like in all these creative agencies and stuff, all want to get their hands on, but nobody could. So it had a little bit of that, but it wasn't really pop culture yet. And I think with Pharrell going to Japan, meeting Nigo, and then being blown away with like everything Nigo had done. Like, if you'd never seen any of it before, and then you show up, you're just like, where did this come from? And of course, he wanted to help Nigo get big in the US, and it was a good time because Bape was kind of not going anywhere in Japan, and it exploded just way beyond anything I would have ever imagined. But so I think there was a couple different threads. I think the hip hop thread is what opened up people to start thinking about fashion that was a little bit more limited edition, that was not baggy and big and bling. And then from there, you know, Kanye takes it to Paris and it becomes super mixed in with kind of high design and high fashion. And then, you know, people are getting into the other brands. And then now you have John Mayer, you know, really into Visvim and Capital and all those brands. So it kind of grew from the music world quite a bit. But yeah, I mean, just to go back to Supreme as well. I mean, Supreme and Bape and all the Japanese brands, they're all kind of students of Stussy, right? And, you know, if you're going to write like a good streetwear history, you know, you start, there's kind of like primordial streetwear that's just like, you know, kids skateboarding and whatever, but it's not really a business, and there's not really streetwear brands that are not just like athletic brands. And streetwear really starts with Stussy because they did something really important, which is like, you know, kind of brought together surfing and skating and in urban culture, but they also intentionally didn't make too much stuff. So as a kid growing up in Florida, like, my friends were into it, but it was kind of hard to get your hands on, and they could have sold a lot more product than they did, but they intentionally didn't. And they've really made it about a community, which it became formalized later as the International Stussy Tribe. And if you look at that tribe, so one of the Japanese guy in that was Hiroshi Fujiwara, who goes on to kind of start streetwear in Japan. I think James Jebbia of Supreme was either officially or unofficially part of it. Michael Koppelman, who does a brand called Gimme Five, or did a brand, I'm not sure, in the UK, who ran the Hideout. So like you had this kind of international group of people who are all the godfathers of streetwear. And when they go out to form brands, they take that kind of idea of only making certain products and really pushing it to its max. And I think in Japan, you see the extreme of it, where what Fujiwara did and what Nigo did with Bathing Ape was like they intentionally made sure that they were undersupplying all the time. And if you talk to them about it, like they're not going to say like it's, you know, in order to make people want it more, but it works that way. And they were making just hand over fist money, but it felt underground, and they were putting it back into the product. So the product was really innovative and the packaging was innovative and the stores were incredible. And it just took streetwear to this new level. But that whole way of selling, doing drops and getting people to line up, that all starts in Japan. And then, you know, Supreme, like if I went to Supreme in like 98 or something in New York, you just walk in, you buy a t-shirt, it's $25. It's like, you know, it's slightly a little bit more prestigious than a different streetwear brand, but it wasn't like really, you know, that big of a deal. But then 2005 or six or something, I check in and like Supreme has lines in front of it, and it's, you know, going crazy the way Bape did in Japan at like 96, 97. But that whole model is exported from Japan. You know, it started in Japan, and now the whole kind of rhythm of street culture and all the assumptions of it, you know, the idea that you're going to make products that are, you know, do the double names, do the collaborations that come out on a certain day and all that, that's all the Japanese model.
So I want to circle back to something else that's been exported from Japan, and I mean the denim. So, and you already talked a bit about, you know, Big John and some of the other brands, but there's a lot more to it.
I talked about the first stage of Japan becoming an exporter of premium denim. So the first stage is just literally kind of random companies learning how to sew jeans, and they're not making denim in Japan. They're importing it all. They're importing all the parts, all the machines, everything from the US, and just kind of having cheaper Japanese labor to make it. And so Kojima, the city in Okayama, develops Big John and then a bunch of other brands that are, you know, literally like the owner of Big John's brother has a company, and then the cousin has a company, and it's just a very family small town operation. Edwin kind of starts at the same time. That was a pretty big brand as well. But they're basically just importing denim from somewhere and sewing. And it's completely imitative of what's happening in the US. The next kind of phase is in the 70s. They start making their own denim just because the American labor mills are not particularly trustworthy. They can't get the denim in time. And also people realize, like, we have an indigo dyeing tradition. Like, we can do this ourselves. So Kaihara starts making Japan's first denim, and a bunch of other companies, Sakamoto Denim, start doing it as well. So you get Japanese denim, but at this point, it's just for mass production. What we think of today of Japanese denim, like the very crafts-like denim, that hasn't happened yet. So in the 70s, Japan's making very high-quality mass-market denim. It's not really 501 denim. It's more like... is it the 505 with the zipper? What's the...
Yeah, the orange tab maybe you're thinking of, or...
Yeah, I think Levi's is buying this Japanese denim from Kurabo, like by the 70s for their Asia Pacific pairs. And so, you know, they're just basically supplying Levi's, but it's en masse. And then, you know, some of the people in that world start getting kind of obsessed with, could we make a version that feels more like the 501 used to feel? And I think there's something happening. First of all, like the jeans market's getting very saturated in Japan, so people are looking for ways to be a little different. But at the same time, there's this cult around the 501, and as they buy new 501s, which are not being made with the same kind of high quality denim anymore, they're realizing like something's different about it. And so they try to kind of copy what a 1950s pair of Levi's feels like. And so they pull out a bunch of their smaller old selvage looms that are used to make sailcloth. So there's a lot of sailcloth production in Kojima in that area, or at least in Okayama in that area. So they pull out the sailcloth smaller looms and they start making Japan's for selvage denim. you know, and salvage denim, as far as I understand, made in the U.S. wasn't like, we're making salvage denim, it's special. It's just that, like, at the time that they're making denim, it's on salvage looms that are just happen to be smaller. And the minute Americans can figure out a way to make it on larger looms to produce more denim, they do, because they're like, these small looms are not particularly effective. So so Japan intentionally kind of goes retro and pulling out its salvage looms to make, you know, get the texture of kind of 50s denim. At the same time, Karabo uses computers to kind of figure out how to make slubby denim. So they're like using high-tech things in order to make like imperfections in the denim, which is kind of interesting. And then brands start using this denim to create reproduction jeans. And the first wave of these brands kind of fails. Like nobody really wants them. But it was also because it was pretty easy to buy a pair of dead stock Levi's, you know, 1966 model jeans in Japan, because they're all being, you know, bought up in the U.S. and shipped back to yeah. Japan.
So and, I believe those jeans were the Big John Rares.
Well, there's Big yeah. John Rares and there's the Studio Dardison ones too, right?
That's right. So Big John Rares, the first to make a pair of salvage denim jeans in Japan, and they were a complete fiasco. Like no one bought them. Everyone thought they were crazy. And then Studio Dardison, the reason he had come back from being kind of a high fashion design assistant in Paris and realized that everyone in Paris was obsessed with 501. So said, hey, I bet we're, you know, people in Japan make good stuff. I bet we can make a pair of jeans that are like 501s from the 50s. And so he makes like a insane, you know, $250 pair of jeans, and everyone thinks he's crazy, and they don't sell particularly well. And so from there, you know, Levi's Japan, the representative is in Paris, and I think he sees a pair of probably Chevignon or Evu in a window that look, they're kind of 501 replicas. And so the Levi's guy says, oh, you know, people in Paris are really into this vintage jeans thing. We should try to make a pair. So the first Levi's vintage clothing comes out of Japan, and they make a replica of the 701 in the mid 80s. And that was also a total failure, because again, you could just buy an actual dead stock pair of these jeans for not that much. But by the late 80s, yeah. those dead stock jeans were like, you know, $2,500, $3,000. They'd just gotten insanely expensive. And so then when Evisu starts making pairs like 1990, 91, and I think because Evisu had the seagull on them, there was something also that felt like a brand mark and people were into that. Then the whole replica denim trend really starts. And then you get these brands just obsessed with who can make the most authentic, high-quality denim, and then it's just gone insane from there. And so it was a process. It wasn't just kind of this continuous, unbroken lineage of cultural tradition that starts in like 860 or something, right? It was a very much 90s thing or 80s thing that eventually in the 1990s became successful.
It's interesting how that parallels, because like there's a lot of stuff where like people talk about like how America, you know, if you go on like denim Instagram right now is still very Americana, very American focused. And yet you forget that not only, you know, the Japanese are really responsible for Levi's vintage clothing, and they're responsible for Red Wing heritage and all that stuff. So it's like, it's very directly like, nah, even the stuff you think is American is actually Japanese in a way.
Yeah. I mean, I do think if you're American, like this stuff, it just doesn't feel special because it's so common. I mean, Red Wings were not something I grew up with. I mean, I grew up in a kind of hot place, probably that's why, but you know, it's the same with Ivy League clothes. Like I grew up wearing really, really preppy clothing that I didn't think of as fashion at like once. You know, wearing a button-down shirt, it was not like I'm wearing fashion. It's just like, this is just what people wear. It's culture. And then you go to Japan, it's like, this is a button-down Oxford shirt from Brooks Brothers. It's so important. It's so iconic. And then you think, oh, I didn't realize this was a big deal. So it does take someone else to kind of, you know, give things that you take for granted a little bit more meaning. And what happened in the U.S. eventually was, you know, because all of this faded as actual culture that just existed in the world, and it was being brought back from zero, then people bringing it back themselves were taking a lot of meaning in it. But they also needed to get other people excited about it. and you need to create meaning. And so they just did the same thing that people in Japan did, which is they kind of imbued everything with these incredible meaning and gave everything this really important aura of authenticity. And, you know, if you're going to sell a pair of $300, $400 jeans, you better have a pretty good goddamn reason for $400. And, you know, so talking about like, we source denim from this and we do the indigo this way and we use this kind of spinning and the yarns, you know, so that then you get to the justification for why it's $400. So there's always kind of a marketing element of this as well.
And I mean, you're touching on a question that I also wanted to ask about Japanese style. So would you say that the Japanese care more about style than us Westerners? And if so, why?
I would say in general, yes. I would say the fashion level of Tokyo is a lot higher. It's not necessarily... Sorry, go ahead.
No. I was just going to agree with you because I've been to London, New York, Tokyo, Los Angeles, Chicago. Tokyo, for me at least, I don't know as much as you do, obviously, but like in my personal experience, by far Tokyo has the best style, like the highest level of care about style for like both men and women. It was amazing. I loved being there, just seeing people that cared about how they dressed. I loved that. It was amazing.
Yeah, and I can totally recognize that from here in Europe. But David, why do you think that is?
So I would say there are a lot of people in Japan who are exceptionally stylish, right? And some of that is, to be really stylish, you need to have a great body of knowledge about style, in the sense of you need to know all the rules, you need to know what's the really clever way to break those rules, you need to know all the ingredients, you need to know all the brands, you need to know all the meanings, right? So, you know, dressing well is having an incredible cultural vocabulary of style. So people here are just more obsessed with it, and so then you get people who end up being very good at that, right? It's like any skill. I think taste is a skill, and so the more you have the ingredients to make good taste decisions, you can. So there's some people like that. I would say on what's interesting about Japan is not the best people, because if you just did a comparison of like the best dressers from London and New York and Tokyo, I think it's a pretty fair competition. It's not necessarily a, you know, Japan definitely wins. But when you look at the average dress style of somebody, it's just so much higher in Tokyo. And I think a lot of that is uniforms are still very important. Like, men still have to wear suits to work if they work in white collar jobs. Even the blue collar jobs have kind of a set uniform that everybody wears. So this idea is that there is a appropriate style of dress for whatever group that you're in is very strong. And so people are, you know, feel a social pressure to live up to that level. I think in the United States for a long time that also existed. I mean, people dressed pretty fancy in the 50s and 60s too, just because the expectations, everybody wears a suit. But that went away. And so it didn't go away in Japan. I think people still dress up. And then their obsession with style as both a status symbol and a cultural import and just a hobby, it just means there's more people who are willing to pay money for things and look good and finesse their looks and experiment and things like that. And so it ends up...
So do they also care more about quality than us here in the West?
I think they care about quality, but I'm kind of mixed on that, because if you just look at what people buy and how they sell it, certainly the stores are really pushing that, you know, that you're going to pay a lot of money for something because it has high quality. But there's if you reverse that a little bit, it's that stores here charge a lot for clothing. Like, if you're going to buy a pair of Cordovan Alden loafers that are, you know, American made shoes, you're going to pay something like $1,200 USD here for an $800 shoe in the US. And things are always more expensive. So to justify that expense, you're going to make a very big deal about high quality and authenticity and all these things. So there's, again, a bit of a marketing aspect to it.
Well, there's also one of the things you mentioned, I remember specifically, is like clothing for Japan is a thing that they can actually have a hobby in. It's more, you said, like, it's more difficult for them to care about like cars and like sports and things like that, just because of the other things about their culture. And the cities and things like that. So like in America, like a lot more people care about like its sports hobbies and like cars and stuff like that. Like I watch a lot of car shows and everybody who's into cars dresses like trash. Like they literally just wear, I mean, like if you watch like Roadkill is a very popular show. Like the two main guys, one of the guys, he's always wearing flip flops and shorts and like whatever plaid. Like that's literally what he wears, just flip flops, shorts, and whatever sports sunglasses, and he can't. It's so weird to me. Like somebody thinks like, "Wow, his car looks so cool," but he looks like such an idiot. Like, can't you just do the whole look? And it's, but like in Japan, and I love Freiberger, I love David Freiberger, I love Roadkill, but like they dress terrible. And Top Gear makes fun of how Jeremy Clarkson like single handedly made things difficult for Levi's because of how poorly dressed he was in the 90s. That is actually a thing. And the like James May, too, that he has a very iconic rugby shirt that he wears. And the brand promised to like give him like thousands of dollars of free clothing if he would stop wearing that rugby shirt on the shows. That's how poorly dressed car people are. Like it's amazing how like if you care enough about it's kind of a thing. I don't know if this is true in the rest of the world, but like if you get into one thing, you can't get into something else almost weirdly. Like,
yeah, I mean, the tech industry is very similar, right? Like people think if you're dressed well, then you must be spending mental energy on anything other than solving tech problems or business problems. And so, you know, there becomes weird, like counter incentives to dressing well. But to your original point, yes, if people aren't buying cars and they can't show off their houses and they can't show off, you know, either what their house looks like or what's inside their house, which is in the case of Japan, like houses are just not public places, then you need somewhere to show who you are and your status. And fashion works really, really well for that because, you know, your friends and your family and strangers are going to see you every day and how you're dressed, but they're not going to see your car because almost nobody, you know, drives to work in Tokyo, and they're not going to see your house because everybody lives kind of far away and they live in relatively small houses that are not particularly interesting. And so clothing is kind of it. And in the US, you know, status in the 50s was all about what car you drove and how, what your house, where your house was, what your house looked like, what your interior design was, how big your TV was, or, you know, whatever, all these things mattered. And if none of those are visible or observable in Japan, then people are going to congregate to what is, and that's clothing. And so that played a very big role. I think that's also why Korea and China, you're probably going to see a lot of fashion culture develop as well. So some of it's not,
it has already in a lot of ways, hasn't it?
Yeah, I was
in
just
a lot of ways it already has it not,
like in Korea and China. I think street fashion has taken both of those places over, and the level of interest in fashion seems to be exploding, but it's way less sophisticated than Japan. And I think what's about Japan is, and I don't mean like it's necessarily better or worse, because that could be a taste judgment other people can make. It's just sophistication in the sense of, in Japan, when someone wears a garment, whether it is vintage denim or it is some, you know, Brooks Brothers blazer or something, they know the history of it, or at least they, you know, if you ask them, they'll say, oh yes, I wore this because of this reason, and I know the story of this garment. That's not really going on in Korea and China as much, as far as I can tell, and I've had conversations with people who work in the industries there. And you know, big brand logos are still a lot bigger in Japan. It's much more subtle the way that people show off, and so there's that difference. But, you know, in 10 years, I think China will catch up, or at least, you know, they'll be a dominant player in the fashion world. And I think that's on the production side and the consumption side.
Great. So I think we're getting to the questions section now of this interview. And I do have a few questions I just wanted to run by you. I'm sure Jake has some too. But if we start with the first one, you've been living in Japan for 16 years now. What's your most memorable experience of being out there?
That is really tough because, you know, 16 years is a lot. And there's a lot of things that have happened, and, you know, it's great. The one thing I will say is I spent a little time in the U.S. a couple years ago, and nothing made me appreciate living in Tokyo more than being away from it. And so I have spent the last couple years just being obsessed with exploring Tokyo. And Tokyo's kind of infinite in the possibilities for exploration in a way that I think New York or San Francisco aren't, or the other cities that like I've spent time in. It's just, it's enormous, endless, and you know, you turn one corner that you've never been in a neighborhood you know really well, and it's some, there's some store that you've never seen before. And so that to me is the thing that I'm obsessed with in Japan. It's just like, you know, feeling like every day there could be more exploration possibilities. And so I've spent a lot of time just trying to go to neighborhoods I never go to, take really long walks across the city and just see what I discover. And that's, I don't have as much time for that as I'd like, but that's what keeps me motivated and always excited to live.
You're saying like essentially like almost my exact thoughts on like my favorite thing about going to Japan and why Tokyo is my favorite city in the whole world. It's my favorite place I've ever been to, essentially, is exactly because of what you're saying. Like, you can go down anywhere and there will just be something cool and beautiful, and or you just walk into any restaurant and it'll be delicious and you won't have had it before, and it's a slightly different than another one. And that's why, and I love New York, and I've been to New York a lot, and New York doesn't even hold a candle to that. And it's probably the best city in America for that, because trust me, I live in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is trash compared to even New York for something like that, because you can't go to most of Los Angeles because it's so dangerous and it's just not that great. But yeah, like that's amazing to hear you say that, because that's exactly like why
it is the, I love Tokyo. The exact same thing that Nick Clemens answered to that question, actually. Another thing I wanted to ask you, we talked about a lot of brands. What's your favorite Japanese brand?
You know, the brand I go back to season after season, and like kind of you know, when I want to go see what's out there to buy, I go to Beams Plus. And you know, you may know Beams, it's a very, very big kind of chain of what are called select shops. So they're kind of boutiques that import a lot of new brands but also sell their own clothing. They have a line called Beams Plus, which is an Americana line, and they do a lot of kind of traditional Ivy League inspired stuff. It's great. It's just, it's not super fussy. It's not overly fancy. And it just, every season will have the exact kind of classic items that I'm looking for. And a great selection of other brands like engineered garments, or I was at a party last night there for rowing blazers. So they just kind of import what's new, but also great stuff. So I shop there quite a bit, and but there's tons. I mean, I super respect Visvim and Comme des Garçons, and I wear a lot of shirts from Comberker Shirts. They do a great made to measure shirt. I have a friend in Okayama who runs a brand called Tsuki, T-U-K-I, that does super interesting trousers. So that's also endless. I mean, if you just kind of go around to shops, you'll discover like five new brands every time.
So, David, what does Made in Japan mean to you?
Made in Japan, that's a great question, because I was just in China and I'm thinking a lot about what Made in China means and how that can change and how it should change, because Made in China today is not necessarily a tag that has the same positive associations as Made in Japan. And if you go back to the 50s, Made in Japan was like Made in China at the time. And so Made in Japan is a brand, right? It's a brand that the Japanese nation created for itself. And today, Made in Japan it means really high quality, super craftsmanship minded, attention to detail, premium. And that was because the brands worked really, really hard and the companies worked really hard to create that and sell that. And they achieve it very well. And I think they also linked it back to a history of craftsmanship, so that it wasn't just, oh, we became very technical and good at things, but oh no, we've, you know, for hundreds of years been obsessed with craftsmanship. And so it's a really strong, really effective brand. And I think it's sometimes detached from reality in the sense that there's other places they do great work in terms of manufacturing. Japan's not the only country that makes great things that are detail oriented, but I think they've just branded it best, so that when you see Made in Japan, you think, ooh, this must be premium. And a good example of that, Beams has a new store called Beams Japan that's in Shinjuku, and it only really sells stuff from Japan. and it's everything. And you used to think like a store like that would just be cool avant-garde Japanese brands, but their first floor is, it's like literally anything Japanese, like the silver serving bowls for curry that you pour over curry rice, like those are now branded and sold as like a made in Japan kind of thing. Or, you know, just pitchers for water or wood chips that they use to cover up when people throw up on the streets and stuff, like that's sold as made in Japan. So it's fascinating that how anything Japanese now has a premium to it because of that label.
Anyway, I got a couple quick questions. Hold on. Well, okay, one little mini shallow one. What's your favorite Japanese food?
I love tonkatsu. The fried pork cutlet.
Which is the food you actually included in the book. I remember that specifically. How the guy talked about how it was originally German and became. That's another great analogy. I love that. Okay, and then a little slightly more deep question. If you had to choose, like, which was your favorite like type of style from Japan that you covered?
That's a great question, because on a personal level, you know, I dress in this kind of deconstructed preppy way that links back to my own personal style from when I was like 8 years old. It's kind of, you know, just wearing the same stuff in a new way. But the chapter that I really enjoyed writing about and I'm actually proudest of is the chapter about the Yankee style, which is the delinquent kind of rock and roll style. And the reason that I'm proud about it is there are some books in Japan that kind of go across this fashion history and with Van Jacket and jeans and all that, but they always leave out the delinquent stuff because, you know, this fashion style and everything in Japan is always for upper middle-class educated kids. And it's made in Tokyo and it's very much focused around an upper middle-class lifestyle. And the story of American style in Japan, you can't tell it without talking about these kids, the Yankee. And Yankee, you know, it comes from the word Yankee, so it's like it has this American root to it, but it was a huge mystery of why they were called Yankee. Nobody ever quite put together how it all happened. And then by tracing the history of it, you know, I actually found, okay, the origin of the style was from Yokosuka, the Navy base town. That's kind of a working class Navy base town, and the kids who were dressed in that style, who were called Yokosuka Mambo or Skaman, those kids had the slick back Regent.
That was like the cream soda and like Pink Dragon and
yeah. So then that becomes kind of rock and roll and Teddy Boy and all that. But, you know, the original version of it, you know, I found this magazine from 1966 in which they're described as having Yankee style in Japanese. And it's like, okay, there I go. It's like this from the very beginning, this idea of dressing like an American delinquent was understood as Yankee, as in like Yankee go home. Like we don't like Americans. And so, that whole chapter, the flow of that style, the way it changes, is an incredible counterpoint.
And what chapter is that in the book?
That's
the Damn Yankees, right?
It's chapter 6, I think, in the book. And it's an important counterpoint to the other stereotype of Japan, which is, oh, Japanese people very reverently protect everything. And they really care about making things exactly like they were in the 50s or whatever, which is true if you're, again, an upper middle class educated person and or a brand that's trying to sell premium clothing. But what you realize with the delinquent kids is that they were dressing like Americans because it was dangerous and because they scared people. And the minute that American style became popular, like, you know, they're dressing kind of like rock and roll kids in leather jackets on bikes with Hawaiian shirts. As soon as that style becomes really popular in Harajuku with kind of the fashion crowd, then they realize it loses its power. And so they abandon American style and they start dressing in these like right-wing paramilitary uniforms.
Yeah, that's right.
So now the bikers are kind of associated with that look. But, you know, the whole point is they don't care about being reverent to America at all. They just want to scare people. And so, you know, it makes the point that when you do this kind of cultural analysis, it really matters what class level you're talking about and how people use the culture, not just that, you know, there's some sort of Japanese, you know, way of dealing with American style that goes across every layer of society. And so that chapter to me is very, very important. And I think without it, the book is a lot more shallow.
Well, there we go. That was a very, very fascinating answer. And I did love that chapter. That's probably... That was probably my second favorite chapter after the streetwear one. Actually, really was my favorite. I couldn't believe it because it's not something I'm really into at all. But that was actually, that actually ended up being my favorite chapter. But the
just because I often get people always like, oh, love the first part of the book, and then when it gets to the streetwear part, it's really boring. It's like, okay.
I don't think so at all. Like what I'm most interested in personally would be the van stuff, even though I love the denim, but like, you know, there's I definitely learned some new stuff, but at the same time, like, there's so much other denim information, right? Like, if you really want to go just into denim, right? Or like, you know, like Real McCoys and like Freewheelers and stuff like that, right? But so, like, personally, I'd be most interested in like the van stuff, like the roots of it, the beginning, right? And because that's what ties into literally everything, right? But I think just because the streetwear thing was, it's something I know very little about. It's not something I'm interested in, and you made it interesting, and showed how that was kind of really the first way that Japanese style and Japanese clothing brands became huge to the rest of the world. So in a way, it is important for me to know that, because perhaps without that, we would not have had the same level of like the Japanese denim coming over and influencing America if it wasn't for brands like, because it wasn't just like a Bathing Ape that came over to the United States. You had like Avis and or was it Avisu? I think probably by that time you had brands like Avisu, which came over as well. So I think that was very important to learn all of that. So
very happy you enjoyed it.
No, I love the book. I could gush for a long time. Like this is probably one of my favorite books now already. Like I really love reading this.
The one thing I'll say is I'm, you know, always really happy to hear that people enjoyed it, but I want to also say that it was so fun to write. And I often read things from authors being like, never write a book, it's the worst thing ever. And like every day I was writing this book, I was just discovering some new detail that I knew that nobody had either seen in Japan for 50 years or no one outside of Japan knew at all. And it was very, very exciting to, you know, in the process of writing it, know that it was going to be unleashed in the world at some point.
So if listeners don't have the book yet, where do they get it? Amazon? That's the easiest, I guess.
Yeah, I honestly, yes. I mean, it is not a well distributed book, unfortunately. So just buy it online.
It's not even expensive. There's really no excuse if you're into Japanese clothing in any way, or if you're into clothing at all, even if you just buy, if you only buy Red Wing and 316, no, you need to buy this book, honestly, because 316 is not only denim, but it's also very streetwear influenced, right? So even if you only buy American brands, your American brands that you wear today would not exist basically without the stuff that's in this book. And it's under $13 on Amazon, and there's for the hardcover. There's no reason not to get it. I'm sorry, there just isn't.
And David, where can people otherwise follow you?
You know, follow me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm often Neo Marxism, NEOMARXISME on Instagram, or David Marks on Twitter. And trying to write a new book right now. I got to sell it, so I won't say too much about it. But working with an agent to try to sell that. And if I don't sell it, it will still come out somehow. So anyway, more on that soon.
That's a cliffhanger. So
nice. Yeah, that's exciting.
That's a perfect way to end this episode then. So thank you so much for coming onto the show, David.
Great. Thank you so much. I love talking about this stuff. And I appreciate you reading it and inviting me on.